Welcome to That's So Hindu, the podcast brought to you by the Hindu American Foundation. I'm Matt McDermott. For this episode, we've got something a little different for you. Regular listeners will remember that at the end of 2023, we had a two-part episode with Indu Viswanathan interviewing a young Hindu man who converted to Islam and then came back to Hinduism. The first part of that title was Hindu by Heart. Now Indu's back. We've tweaked the title a little bit and are turning it into a regular feature called Hindu at Heart, with her first guest being author Aditi Banerjee, who was one of the first guests on the show a couple years ago. So without more ado, here are Indu and Aditi.
Welcome to Hindu at Heart. I am your host, Indu Viswanathan. Every episode, I will be speaking with an inspiring American-born Hindu as they share their journeys, triumphs, and the meaningful struggles that shape their lives. This week, I'm thrilled to be joined by my friend, Aditi Banerjee. Aditi is a published author and novelist. Her first novel, The Curse of Gandhari, a successful bestseller, was published by Bloomsbury India in September 2019. Her second novel, The Vow of Parvati, was also published by Bloomsbury India in 2022. She has also published Hindu love stories, Dharmically Ever After, a collection of stories from Hindu literature and history. She is a practicing attorney at a Fortune 500 financial services company in the U.S., and has also completed an executive MBA at Columbia University. She earned a Juris Doctor from Yale Law School and received a BA in International Relations, magna cum laude, from Tufts University. She is a prolific and inspiring writer and speaker about Hinduism and the Hindu American experience. She's a member of the Indic Academy and Indic Book Club, which sponsored a successful six-city book launch tour for The Curse of Gandhari in September 2019 across India. She co-edited the book, Invading the Sacred, An Analysis of Hinduism Studies in America, in collaboration with Rajiv Malhotra, and has authored several essays and publications, such as the Columbia documentary History of Religion in America since 1945, and Buddhists, Hindus, and Sikhs in America, A Short History by Oxford University Press. Her articles have also been published in Outlook India and many other publications. Welcome, Aditi.
Thank you so much. I'm really happy to be here and talking with you.
Wonderful. And I wish you could see her face. She has a beautiful, shining, smiling face. So why don't we start with something kind of fun? Why don't you share a favorite childhood memory related to a Hindu festival or celebration?
Sure. So I remember we were not a particularly religious family growing up. But what I do remember being part of the Bengali community was every October, there'd be some weekend where we'd gather in a high school in the Chicago area and have Durga Puja, as we called it. So this would be during Navratri. But at that time, I did not even know what Navratri was. I just knew that once a year, all these Bengalis got together and there's like a huge deity of Ma Durga, and she was like beautiful and majestic, and there'd be people like beating on the drums, and there'd be like this Anjali like ceremony, and I didn't even know what was happening, and no one explained it to me or no one explained it to anyone else, but you were just part of it, and it was very absorbing and it was very powerful, and I felt this connection even though I didn't really have the tools to understand what was happening. But that's something that stayed with me, is that sense of connection with the divine and this very beautiful, fierce Devi. That was like, it was very unique. And that sense of kind of community, where there'd be people you may not see the whole rest of the year, but everyone was wearing their saris and things like that, or salwar kameez, and we get together. So that was kind of my earliest experience of that. And once in a while, we go to the temple locally, but that was really an experience that stayed with me. And I think that made me curious to learn more.
Yeah. I can kind of feel that celebration in the way you're describing it. Let's backtrack a little bit. Tell us a little bit about your family. When did your family immigrated from India? When did they immigrate? Siblings, kind of give us a sense of who was attending these functions.
Sure. So my parents came from Kolkata like in the late 1960s, around that wave of immigrants. And then I have one older brother. He's like 8 years older than me, so he's kind of like a third parent. And they were in the Chicago area. So that's where I grew up, in the suburbs of Chicago. Mm-hmm. And so I think their experience was very different from ours, because when they came, we didn't really have like Indian grocery stores nearby. You didn't have a lot of Indian restaurants. I remember like once a month we'd go, there's a street called like Devon Street. So it's all the way like in Chicago. So you travel for like an hour and they do like all these groceries and there's like one Indian grocery store there. And then you'd have to like stock up for a long time before you could come back. So a lot of things that we take for granted now, like I go, like once a week I go to Patel Brothers and get like all the vegetables I want and things like that. But it was very different then. And so I think their sense of what it means to assimilate or integrate is very different from like our generation. So that's been kind of an interesting to see. And I think they also identified much more with Bengalis. So it was kind of like that ethnic regional type of affiliation versus I think now we tend to associate more with like as or identify with at least I do as a Hindu or as like a as an Indian or as like an Asian American. So kind of like different types of identities and different experiences.
Yeah. And so you grew up in a suburb of a fairly kind of global city. What was that suburb like? Were there other Bengalis, other Indians in your school growing up? What was that like?
It was, I think it was like fairly diverse in that there were other Asians, there were other Indians, but I never thought of myself as such, which is, it may sound a little bit weird, but it wasn't until I got to college. And then like when I got to college, there was this proliferation of like associations with like an Asian club, we had like a South Asian. And I was like, oh, like that's kind of like one of my identities. So like growing up, like there were other Indians and other Asians, but I never had that like consciousness. And so there were things like just like growing up where I feel like I was like teased or I felt like different or I felt kind of like an outsider, but I never had a way to put a voice to like what exactly that was. I'm just like, I think we tend to like personalize those things. I'm like, oh, it's just like me. But like actually being able to systematically look at it and see that there's like a bigger experience going on. Like I didn't really have that. So growing up, I didn't even like think about those things or how, you know, it'd be difficult or how people would like call me like Adidas and like make fun of my name. And I was just, is this something that's like, oh, like that's just something that happens. But I never kind of like analyzed or thought like, oh, this is happening to me because I'm ethnically different or they have like a Sanskrit theme or all those things. So I was just like, I just be like faintly embarrassed about it, but not really be able to make sense of what was happening.
When did that kind of click for you to look back on your memories and realize, oh, there was something actually bigger happening?
I think it was like, so there were like incidents. Like I remember when I was in high school and I was in an American history class. And there were two things. One is like you had like a, I don't know, like a few weeks on like religions of the world. So like Hinduism and Buddhism were together. And I remember like my teacher said something that was like obviously wrong. And I don't even remember what it was. But I just said like, oh, no, that's not correct. I think it was something about like the definition of karma. And he got all offended. And he was like this kind of like old white man. And he was like, I've read 3 books about Hinduism. So like, how dare you? So I was just like, wow. And like, you know, we're brought up to like revere our teachers. So like to me, for me to like have that, I was like, oh wow, like, you know, that's crazy. But it didn't sit well with me. And I had another experience where there was like another history teacher who's like kind of reading out this article from this newspaper about like a pilot who like landed in this remote village in India and he was like garlanded by the villagers. And like the teacher was kind of like making fun of this. So we're like the other students were kind of like laughing along because like, oh, like these primitive people are like worshiping this foreigner. It's like a god or whatever. So that was like really insensitive and just like also culturally ignorant of what it means to like welcome an atithi or a guest. And I remember there was like another student who was Korean and he brought like kimchi once and people just were like, oh, like your food smells or like all this kind of stuff. So that was kind of there. So those things didn't sit well with me. But like I said, I didn't have a way of like analyzing or understanding that. So I think it was really when I got to college, I became very involved with like our Asian American associations or even like our South Asian student associations. And when they got involved with like Hindu Students Council, not at Tufts where I went to college, but like in other Boston chapters. And then I was like realizing, oh, like there's this pattern of things that a lot of us are going through. And then coming across the work of like Rajiv Malhotra or like others and like being able to like put kind of like a name or like being able to like identify it. So then I was like, then I was able to like understand these things in a different perspective.
Yeah. Yeah. And what did that feel like to have that? Like, oh, this isn't just generic sort of exotification or xenophobia. This is something specific.
It was very, in a way, it was very shocking. And I think it was kind of shocking because I think you kind of grow up. I think we all grow up being like idealistic. And you think like things should just work and like things are just going to be fair. And like, it's just this kind of people, you know, it should just be like, it should just work. And I think when you see that it doesn't, it's just kind of very shocking. And I think it comes like in different ways. It comes like being a woman, it can come as being like an ethnic or racial minority or religious minority or things like that. But to me, it was shocking. And I remember when I read, I think it may have been Conrad Elst's book about Ayodhya. And it was shocking to me because it was around that time when I'd read like little snippets in newspapers and also about like Hindu fascism and like, oh, this like terrible, like nationalist, like violence and stuff. And then when I read what it actually was, and of course I knew what like Ayodhya was and like the birthplace of Sri Ram, like I knew that, but the mosque that was there like hadn't been used for so long. It just seemed very like obvious that there was this like rightful feeling, even if you don't agree with what ends up happening to that site, but at least that there's a valid feeling of pain and longing and a wish to reclaim the sacred space. Like, it's just so obvious to me. But the fact that we were being condemned for even having that feeling, like that to me, I think that triggered me wanting to become more active and involved because it just felt so wrong and unfair and and just not acceptable.
Mm. Yeah. When did you start writing about all this and what got you interested in actually? So when did you start writing in general? Because you're such a beautiful writer. And then what kind of got you interested in writing about these topics, about Hinduism or Hindophobia?
So I think for me, I was writing since I was a child. I'd write these like really silly poems. So it was actually funny. I was at my mom's house last week and I found like she had like a folder of these really old poems. And I was like sharing them with my husband. I was like, I thought he'd love them. He just like laughed at them. So I've always loved writing. But for me, it was around that time, I think like very like kind of early on in my college years. When it was kind of starting to hit home to me because I was taking classes on like Indian history and I was seeing like all this like bias. And at the same time, personally, I was going through like it just meant like Hinduism meant a lot to me. I was starting my own practice. I had visited some of the temples in India that were really important. And so it meant a lot to me personally and viscerally. And so I felt like I wanted to kind of do something. And so I'd write and speak about it. And I think there was also kind of like a vacuum because, like I said, I feel like the earlier generations was very kind of ethnic and regional. And I really felt like that, like we have to, you know, move from that to something that's focused on like on Hindu American, right? Because, you know, like for us, we're not going to have the same tie to India. And then like future generations are not going to have that tie like at all, or it'll be in, like in a different way. But there still is a very distinct Hindu American experience. And I really kind of want to focus on that. And then I think so much of the discourse, to the extent there is discourse about Hinduism, is just dominated by Indian issues and Indian people. We have to carve a future for ourselves, like, you know, here. And so much of it is kind of like backward looking or projecting kind of things that are going on in India, or like India specific political dynamics and things like that, and projecting that onto people here. Many of whom have never even been to India. And so I think there just needs to be like a shift in kind of perspective, which is why I love that you're doing this podcast, because there's so little of this and it's so important.
Yeah, absolutely. And what comes to mind for me now is, you know, we have an opportunity to really imagine a future of what is Hindu America, what is Hindu Americanism. Mm-hmm. And I think you and I probably both observed and studied and examined how we have been the objects of study by others, but what happens when we kind of take the reins and we determine who we are and how we are here. You know, we're second gen, my children are third gen, yours will be, et cetera. We're looking at future generations. And as you've so aptly described, it's not going to be the same as our parents, and it's not going to be the same as Hindus living in India, but it can still be distinctly Hindu. It's not sort of inevitably deracinated. Yeah. Which I think is the sort of forecasting that you might hear from some people. But I think that you and I are proof of concept that that's not always the case. It's not necessarily the case that there are other possibilities out there, actually.
And it is very much like a possibility, because even if you look in history, like when Buddhism went from India to China, it really like transformed. But then like, and it spread so much further, but even like Hinduism, you go to like Bali today and it's so staunchly Hindu. And like, this has happened before. Like our ancestors were very like adventurous. They went to distant lands, and without being violent, without invading, they influenced cultures without, you know, taking away what was already like locally there. So we have like really good templates for how this can be very successful. And I think part of it is just we lack confidence, or we're so like insecure, or we're just like afraid of like change or things like that. But I think one of the really good things about being American is like there's so much like confidence here, sometimes unwarranted confidence, but like learn to be confident and also to like be a bit adventurous and things like that. And there's a lot from like the American side of things that I think can be enriching to Hindus as well. And I think we have to embrace that instead of just kind of having this idea that anything that's Western is just like materialistic or bad or not as good as what is Indian, because that's also like a bigotry that kind of comes into it. But I think to like be able to like embrace that and all the good things that we can find here is also very important.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, one of the things that really draws me to your writing, and sometimes it's not just, but sometimes you very simply just share an experience that you've had or something you've just gone through on like a Facebook post. But I find it to be so resonant because there's so much joy and beauty and there's no dogma. There's no should in any of it. It's just joy and beauty and reverence, but from an American voice. And you don't often hear reverence from American voices. And I think that's where people think you can't be both Hindu and American, because so much of American culture is irreverent and in a wonderful way. But that irreverence is not necessarily incompatible with mm-hmm. a very dharmic reverence. And I think you capture that beautifully, you know, in your travels across the country or even in your daily practice. You're finding you express these beautiful moments of dharmic reverence and expression, but it's very grounded here in America. How did you find your way there? From, you know, you described earlier how you weren't really raised very religiously. And I wouldn't necessarily, I mean, Hinduism is so elusive in pinning down what category it fits under. Maybe it fits all categories. So I wouldn't even describe my experience of what you write as religiosity. Maybe you would, I don't know. But how did you find your way to this place where this is how you're experiencing being Hindu in America?
Yeah, so I think it's a few different things. So, I would observe that, like, my mother would do, like, a really small, like, puja. Like, she just, like, light, you know, like a candle, and she had some vigrahas and an altar, and she would do that. And I was like, oh, that's kind of, like, a nice thing to do. And so I didn't know what to do, but, like, after I would take a shower, I would just, like, light a stick of incense. And then I think I had, like, a little picture of Krishna, and then I would read. I had like the collected works of Swami Vivekananda. So I'd like read 5 pages from that, and like that was it. And it's like that's not like a formal sadhana, but like for me that was like kind of like all I had access to, and it worked. And I think that's a really beautiful thing about, and like here I call it Sanatana Dharma, because it's just like universally true, which is like you may not know what to do, but if there is sincerity and there is intent, like it just works. And I think there's so much, like you said, like should and should not, and then people just got like frozen, and then they just don't do like anything. But it's just like it's just very simple, and it's really you can start anywhere and then you'll get to where you need to. So it started with that, and then, you know, because I couldn't read Bengali, I couldn't read like Hindi or Sanskrit, like all I had were like English language resources, and we don't really have like a lot of things on the internet then. So I'd go to the library, I'd take whatever books I could find. They're all like written by, like, you know, like Westerners for like the most part. But there was this like one book by Vanna Mali. She writes beautiful books on like this was on the stories of the life of Krishna, but she does this for like different devas. And each chapter had like one name of Sri Krishna. like I wrote all those down and I'm just like start reciting it. And so it was things like that. And then I think I found a book on TM, like Transcendental Meditation. So I like tried different things, but it wasn't really systematic until I found my guru, which was like later when I was in law school. But those were like the things that like started me on this, because I think I felt very, maybe just like alienated, or I wasn't naturally like happy. But when I did this thing, I found like there was like a source of something like deep, and it was very peaceful and it was inspiring. I was like, oh, there's something more than all of this. And so there were a lot of like steps I took in that direction. I remember the one time when I was about 12 years old, went to India and went with like my grandmother to Vrindavan. And that just like profoundly impacted me, even though I didn't know all the stories associated with Vrindavan yet. But like those trips to India also like awoke something. And then it took a long time for it all to kind of like come together, where like now I do have like a very fixed, regular, like daily practice. And like sadhana is like the most important part of my life. And I was able to read all these books and kind of like understand kind of the metaphysical framework. But I do think it's very much based on experience. And I feel like as a people, we're very focused on, you know, like education and the intellect, which is all great. I think we tend to go very abstract. And so everything's about like explaining or analyzing or things like that. But you really have to, it's just like anubhava. And then that's what, you know, like when our sages say they're seers, because they literally see it or they have this experience. And so all of this kind of indirect knowledge is not worthwhile until you translate it into like actual realized knowledge. And so I think there's been like a lack of focus on experience, which is really sad, because the experience is so beautiful and you don't need a lot of words. It's like if you can just share that experience with someone else, like the experience of watching an arati at a temple, or, you know, reading a story about our devas, like it's so beautiful and captivating that people just automatically become attracted. But I think instead we try to like explain and like defend and justify. But it's really the experience that I think will bring people in.
Yeah, that's really beautiful. And it's captured so beautifully in a lot of your writing. You do a beautiful job of translating the experience, which isn't always easy to your reader. So I really, really appreciate that.
Yeah.
What does I think this idea of sadhana is central to my practice as well. But I feel like not everyone necessarily understands what it is. What is sadhana? How would you describe what sadhana is and why it's meaningful?
Yeah, so I really think of sadhana as practice. I think it really means like, you know, the etymology of it means like there's a goal, and then sadhana is what you do to like move towards that goal. Mm-hmm. And I think it can come in a lot of different ways. So there's a big BAPS temple that was built near my home in Robbinsville. It's like the second largest Hindu temple in the world after Angkor Wat. And I've been there a few times. And what was really interesting to me is I feel like there I'm able to see kind of like karma yoga, and like karma yoga is like a sadhana. So I came across a volunteer who's like a graduate student, like very far away. And he takes the train like 2.5 hours each way to come volunteer at the temple for like 7 hours a day, and then go back in the midst of like all his other studies as well. And like that is a sadhana, right? So it's something I feel that you do out of like nishta, or this conviction, and it's a practice and you're devoted to it. And then that fructifies into different things. So really kind of on the spiritual path. But I think that's what it is. And it can be different things. It doesn't have to be just doing like puja, although I think puja is just like very underestimated, and it's kind of like dismissed as something like, oh, like our grandparents did, or it's like superstitious, or it's like ritualistic, which I hate that word. But it can be even things like your dietary practices, or like fasting or abstaining from things, or like vratas. There's so many different things that you could do. It can be like traveling to sacred sites, and like every year you make a commitment to go to a new dham or something like that. But I think there is this importance of doing this even outside of being like a Hindu. Like when I was in Colombia, I took this class, which is like one of the most, I think it's the most popular class still. in the business school, which is all about like kind of finding like meaning and kind of like happiness and fulfillment. But all of that is about kind of like building practices or like building like a daily regime through which you kind of like find strength and things like that. So even from like a scientific perspective, there's kind of like a lot of study about this. And so I think this is developing a daily practice, and it doesn't have to be very long, what's like 15 minutes or 30 minutes, but then that daily practice just becomes like your bedrock of strength and like fulfillment and discipline. And I can see this now also as my mother is aging, but the importance of kind of having this discipline or these things built up that kind of see you through like your later years. And so kind of like building the reserves while you can, and while like you're young and energetic and kind of invest this energy. Cause sometimes we think of sadhana or like religious practice as something you do when you're old and retired, you have like nothing better to do, but actually by that time, it's really too late. Like the practice, you have to put that in now. And that's when you kind of like reap the benefits of it. And then I think another part of it is like we associate sadhana with kind of like asceticism or kind of like being away from the world. But in a way, it helps you. You can have these beautiful experiences and kind of enjoy the world, but in a different way. And I think that's also missing, just kind of this positive like celebration or happiness, or it makes you feel more connected to the world and things like that. So I think there are a lot of misconceptions, but this is like what our rishis and our ancestors knew, that you bring this into your life, bring this into your home, it makes you healthier in so many ways. And when we think of like the purushartha, and it's like, it's not just moksha, but even like in pursuing artha or wealth and kama and desire, you still need like that base, and sadhana is that base.
Yeah, such a beautiful description. Thank you for sharing that. And I think your point about this perception that sadhana means you're like living in a mountain somewhere alone, not eating or wearing clothing is an unfortunate misconception, because sadhana helps us engage in the world in actually really, in not just dharmic ways, but in ways that you're really experiencing the world in such a different way, with such bright eyes, with this kind of innocence that we don't get access to over time, the innocence that's kind of lost. It brings us back into our lives, this kind of juiciness. Yes. Into our lives. That's just, it's so delightful. So it's the opposite of this idea of this austere sort of detached life. It's actually quite lively. It's enlivened.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah.
I want to go back to talking a little bit about puja, because I think you brought up some really nice points, and I kind of want to dig into it a little bit and kind of contextualizing it within this broader observation. And I would love to hear what you think about this. This kind of impulse, especially in our encounters with the West or the Westernized mind or living in the West, that in order for Hinduism to be taken as seriously as Western religions, we need to remove all of the things that seem heathenistic from it and present ourselves as something that is respectable. And puja and rituals are not respectable, and therefore we should have evolved from that in our descriptions or a practice of Hinduism to be seen as equals.
Yes. And I think what's really sad is this becomes so internalized too, because I think a lot of like Hindus, even when they're aspiring, they just want to go straight to like kind of like Vedanta or like meditation. And like this whole idea, like it just seems very primitive and backward and like your grandparents did. And it's just such a profound misunderstanding. And I think now we're starting to see some of this become more popular and mainstream, like discussions of like Tantra and like Deva Upasana. And so that's great. But I really think like it's so beautiful. And the other thing that we shy away from is from having like, you know, polytheism is kind of like a bad word, but they do like having multiplicity of deities. And yes, we would say they're all aspects of like the one Brahman, but like you can have different relationships with different deities. And then those deities have relationships with each other, right? So it's beautiful to me. You have like Shiva and Parvati, and they have a Ganesha and Karthik, and they all have like relationships with each other. And like we shy away from this because like if we have this like inbuilt bias against that. But for me, you know, when I first started puja, it was like I had this devotional feeling towards Krishna, and it started from there. But over time, like what has happened is like when I go to my puja car and I have like a room full of like vigrahas and images, but it's gotten to the point where I have like very different relationships with different deities. And when I'm sitting there and I haven't gone insane, but I have like conversations, like interactions, like I can look at them and feel like how they're feeling today. Or if I do the Abhisheka, like, is the bath water too warm or too cold? Do they like the prasad I prepared? And I'm definitely not crazy, but that's kind of like the bhava or like the rasa or like the experiences that come. It's really like this lila, which is kind of this play that happens between the divine and us. And you can experience that in so many different forms. Like when my relationship with Krishna is different from my relationship with Shiva. And this is something I think was very natural to us before, and people would talk about these things, this is very commonplace, but we've become very alienated from that. And so I think if you told people that you have the opportunity just to build relationships with like living dynamic deities who are there, like watching over you, protecting you, giving you company, giving you like joy in all these different ways and love, the people would be like, who wouldn't want to do that? You know, and if you want to pick just one, you can pick one. If you want to have multiple, like, and it's something that's very like beautiful, but we really shy away from that. And it's really sad because so much of our strength as a people, as a faith, as like a civilization has come from that. So, you know, like on January 22nd, we had the prana pratishtha of Sri Rama in Ayodhya, but that wouldn't have happened without like 500 years of people making incredible sacrifice. Like there was this one woman who for like, you know, she's kept a vow of silence until the prana pratishtha happened. So for like decades, she hasn't said a word. Like, where does that come from? It comes from puja, which puja is like really nothing but having like a saguna, like relationship with the form of the divine. And then that's just how you express it. But that's been like the bedrock of what we are is kind of this very living relationship with our deities. And I think that's, if I look back at like other cultures, like the ancient Greeks or the ancient Romans, like what happened to them and how they were like destroyed, like, you know, it's really sad. But I think it's when you take that relationship and make it like abstract or just philosophical instead of like that practice or that really real relationship, then it becomes ossified and it's easy to break. I think we haven't broken because we've kept that bond between our deities and us. And sometimes it's like just your home deity. It's just your ancestral deity that's been passed down generation to generation. And all you have to do is just keep that flame going. And that's what's nurtured us for so many thousands of years. And I really do think it's that puja and that bhakti and that very intimate relationship with the divine that has kept us from going extinct.
Mm-hmm. That's really, really beautiful. This eternal light that's never gone away. You know, as you're describing, it's impossible for me listening to you not to feel bhakti arise inside of me. You have such a sincere relationship with this. It's really beautiful. I also wanted to share a little anecdote. So we lived in India when my children were very little. And so Hinduism was normal for them. And then when we moved back here, my younger son, Ajay, came back from school one day and said, Amma, did you know that a lot of the kids here only get one God? Which was like such a fantastic like flip of the script.
I love that.
Right?
But it's so true because, and if you think about it, like, it just makes us so, I don't even know what the right word is, but if you think about the therapy, right? Like if you just have like one form of therapy for everyone or one form of like physical exercise, like, you know, that wouldn't work because everyone's so different. They have different constitutions, different temperaments, different bodies. And it's like, we know that. And that's why there's like proliferation of forms of the divine, of paths, of practices that seem contradictory with each other, but they're not. But I think just like the care that our rishis had and our acharyas had to make sure that there's like a space for everyone.
Yeah.
You know, like there's dharma for like everyone. I like, it's so,
Talk about DEI.
Yeah, exactly. Like that's the definition of being inclusive and multicultural and everything.
And pluralist and really just celebrating the actual diversity of life and experience on this planet, right? Because it emerges from the earth up.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Speaking of the earth up, I just gave myself a great segue. Let's talk about your new book, which is about sacred geography and sacred Hindu spaces. So tell us about your new book, what inspired it, and whatever you want to share about it.
Sure. So the name of the book is Kashi, The Valiant History of a Sacred Geography. So it'll be out probably in this coming March. And this kind of stemmed from, it was like about 8 years ago, I made my first trip to Kashi. And I went to Kashi Vishwanath Mandir and like, it was a beautiful experience. Everything was great. But then I saw this Nandi who was looking off towards like the Ganvapi Mosque. So for people who don't know, there's a Kashi Vishwanath Mandir, which is it's a Jyotirlinga. It's the most famous or most important temple in Kashi. But it's right next to what's called the Ganvapi Mosque. You know, Ganvapi, it's like Ganavapi. So it actually means like well of wisdom. So that's part of this very sacred site. And this the Kashi Vishwanath temple was torn down 3 times and then rebuilt each time. And then this was a mosque that under Aurangzeb's orders was constructed after raising down the temple. But one wall of the old temple was like left as kind of like a poke in the eye, like literally to Hindus to see like here, like look at like how we've kind of triumphed over you.
And just to clarify, who tore down the temple 3 times?
The different Muslims in different eras. So over a span of hundreds of years.
Right. So just to clarify, it wasn't torn down by other Hindus. It was torn down by settler colonists.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you for that clarification. And also what that also means is each time it was rebuilt in a time of colonial oppression when it was dangerous to do so. So again, just like the pakti and like the courage of our people and the devotion. It's really remarkable. Like imagine you live in a city full of temples. It's torn down and they say, I'm going to rebuild. And you know that it's probably going to be torn down again, but you just keep rebuilding. Like that resilience, it's really remarkable. And you haven't really seen that elsewhere. And again, I don't mean that as a mark of like superiority, but I just think like how much was taken from people, from like pagan indigenous people like across the world where they couldn't even have the chance to rebuild. So the Nandi there's a Nandi there that's like facing towards that. And when I saw that, I felt like I can still remember that feeling. And it's hard for me to put words to, but I felt like very bereft. And I could feel like it was like Nandi's pain, which is also like our pain, but just Nandi's always looking at Shiva. And this idea like Nandi just kind of, you know, being there and not having his master, you know, gazing back at him. Master isn't the right word, but, you know, Mahadeva gazing back at him. And that really stayed with me. And of course, if you go all across Kashi, you'll see marks of this. And I had a similar feeling when I went to Mathura and saw the huge mosque that just towers over Sri Krishna's birthplace. So that feeling had stayed with me. And then I was reading something about the Naga sadhus. And, you know, the first time in the 1660s, when Aurangzeb sent his military to try to take over Kashi and Kashi Vishwanath, the Naga sadhus, like thousands of them, had defended the temple. And, you know, they're yogis, they're ascetics, they're sadhus, but they were also acting in that moment as warriors defending the sacred site. And that really moved me. And so I started, you know, I knew kind of a lot of the stories about the history of Kashi, but I wanted to kind of research this and write this book and that story. And then as I was doing that, I was reading the Skanda Purana. And I first just, my first instinct was to write a book that was going to be more of an argument. And the argument was going to be like why, you know, the entire site should be restored to the Hindus. And I had like a very good argument for that. But when I read the Skanda Purana, it changed my mind because the Skanda Purana has this huge section. This is the Kashi Kanda. And all of this is just lore about Kashi and the different sacred sites of Kashi. But it's so meticulous, like, you know, hundreds of Shivalingas, hundreds of like sacred tanks, sacred sites are recounted and like they're kind of laid out very precisely on where they were. I just think how much, again, like how much devotion and faith like our ancestors had to like to meticulously record and document this because they wanted it to, because it was that important to them. And that's what really brought me to the idea of just like sacred geography and the importance of it. And I think we've kind of forgotten what that is, because I see that even when we talk about like Ayodhya, it's very history centric. It's very much like, oh, you know, like Sri Rama was like born here and there was a temple here. And now it's kind of like on this date, this building was at this archaeological site. And that, again, is like a very Western lens, right? Because the Western faiths are all about historicity. Like, so like, if Jesus Christ didn't actually exist and walk on the earth, like Christianity would fall apart. But it's not like that for us. And this idea of looking at things through like sacred geography, which is like, this is Ayodhya because it's Ayodhya, and this is what Ayodhya means to us. And like, it's not just like fantasy, because it's kind of meticulously recorded there in our sacred geography and our lore. And like, you know what, today becomes called like mythology, and we don't want to use that word. But that's how the vast majority of the world, for the vast majority of history, has understood ourselves and their civilizations. That's what like Egypt was about, and the pyramids of Egypt, and like Delos and Delphi. Like, they're very specific about those sites and why they're important. And it's not because some historical event happened there, but because spiritually and metaphysically and civilizationally, it meant something to those people. And so this idea of that sacred geography and what that is of Kashi, and like that ended up being half the book. Because again, going back to experience, like I can tell you that this is what Kashi is, but if you read these stories, it'll be like, oh, like this is what Agastya Muni did, and this is how he felt when he was exiled from Kashi. And if you go to this linga, like this is who installed it, and this is what happened there, and that's like the Mahatmya, and all this Stala Purana and the sacred lore, which again we dismiss as superstition, but if you just read that, you'll feel this like bhakti for Kashi. You'll feel the sense of like how important it is. And that's what gave, I think, our people the strength to keep rebuilding, is because there's so much power in those stories and those experiences. And so the book really became about like transmitting and sharing that experience, so people can value intrinsically what these sites mean, not just in Kashi, but like all over India.
So this idea of sacred geography is not, it's not just something you kind of formulated on your own. It exists in literature. It exists, and not just for Hindus, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Can you share a little bit about, you know, I know you did some research on that more broadly. Can you share a little bit on that?
Sure. So again, it was a confirmation of like whether it's like Native Americans here, or like the Aborigines, or even like the ancient Greeks. But the way that you understand space and like place, and sometimes spaces have, it's the way you experience a space. And then it has like meaning, as it could be like cultural meaning, it can be spiritual meaning. Sometimes it's because a god has a special connection there. Or it can be like the site itself has some special, you know, like characteristics and attributes. Like in China, for example, a lot of it's based on like feng shui and like the energy of the place and like the topography of it and things like that. But so you have like sites, or like when the Buddhists do pilgrimage in Tibet, they're like their mandalas and like cosmic mandalas. And so you go through this process of a spiritual process. So even as you're making like a physical journey, you're going through like a spiritual process. But the idea is like how people have understood space and experienced it. And I think nowadays we think of like it's like property, you know, like ownership of property, and like who has the title or who has the deed or who has like the possession of it. And I think sacred geography makes you look at it in a different way. And it's not about the physical material land, but it's about you know, like cultural claims or civilizational claims, or having the importance of having access and more custodianship rather than like ownership. So a lot of it, you know, a lot of it isn't even so much wanting to own something, but if you care for a place, right? So you could love Kashi and just be distraught to see all the kind of like overdevelopment that's happening. So you have this kind of sense of custodianship for like the future generations and things like that. So when you bring that lens to it, I think it just makes the discourse about it much, much richer. And it's hard to give voice because, again, if you just go through the law is itself very premised on like Western notions. And again, it's very like history centric. But like, what if Hindus had never had a temple in Janmabhoomi site? Like, what if it had always been sacred to us, but for whatever circumstance, we just never were able to build a temple on it? Would that make our entitlement any less? I don't think so. I don't think it's about that we were there first. It's about like this land has special meaning to us. And it's just different. And that doesn't mean that's always going to be dispositive, but it does mean that that should become like a factor, like a consideration. It should at least be validated. And I think right now there isn't even validity given to these kinds of claims or this notion that a site is just like sacred. I don't have to prove it like archaeological evidence, but it's just like throughout history, it's been this collective understanding. And this is how we've understood ourselves for so long. And just being given voice to that or acknowledging that itself is so hard, even today.
Yeah. You know, what's coming up for me, and you're a lawyer as well, so you're the perfect person to talk to about this, is this notion. And when I've spoken with Indigenous scholars here in the West, they voiced this as well, that it's not just that the law as we understand it almost globally reflects Western values, it reflects Western metaphysics, mm-hmm. right? And yeah. So you've now, and those metaphysics, of course, emerge from religion.
Yes.
So while the law sort of has this pretense of being objective, it's actually reflecting concepts about what it means to be in the world, ontologies, and our relationship to each other and the planet and animals and everything that stem from particular religious concepts. They're not universal. Mm-hmm. And so then you think about Indian law and how it interacts with sacred geography in India. And what did you make of how the Indian courts or the Indian justice system negotiated what happened in Ayodhya?
I think it was just like over, in a way, it was like overcomplicated because it's just like, I think if you just lay the facts out, it's just very like compelling. And it's sad that we had to like resort to like so many decades in the court of the very like arcane arguments and things like that. And we're just kind of like at the whim of this court, like based on kind of very outdated laws, like this Places of Worship Act of like 1991. Which it has a special exception for Ayodhya, but this idea that as of 1947, the religious character of different sites was like arbitrarily frozen in time, and you couldn't do anything about it. It's just so like it just doesn't. That just it's not workable. It's not like, you know, it's not sustainable. And so I think part of as you said, part of this is us freeing ourselves from the clutches of like Western metaphysics or Western notions, or exploring different ways that are more authentic to us and to societies all over the world. And I think that, again, there's this kind of like fear that if you do that, it's going to lead to like fascism. And that in itself is like a very bigoted view, which is, it's just like our only hope to not be subject to like dictatorship or fascism or Hitler or whatever is to rely on like Western universalism, which is, it's very ridiculous because Western universalism is what led to like most of the bloodiest wars in like the, you know, the 20th century and for a long time. But there is kind of this notion and this fear. And I think a lot of the ugly discourse that you're seeing around Ayodhya in the West is from this fear of like, oh, look, like these natives are getting uppity and thinking they can decide things on their own without, you know, without following exactly what we said.
I love that framing. Oh, look, these natives are getting uppity. I think that's fantastic.
I do think that, and that's why I think things like sacred geography are important, kind of like notions and like frameworks to understand things that should be obvious but have become like, you know, alienated from us.
And alienated from us is, I think, a key part of this. What are some common misunderstandings you've seen even amongst Hindus who might have even been for approved of the decision that was made around Ayodhya? What do you see are some common misconceptions about sacred land amongst Hindus?
Yeah, so that's a really good question, because I think there is a lot, and I see this happening more, because like I love going to the Himalayas, and I've gone like from like 2006 onwards, and like it hurts me to go now, because you go to these places and it's just like full of people just like taking pictures to post like Instagram, and so it's kind of like a desecration that we're doing ourselves. And so the idea that you have like a kshetra, so not just like the temple itself, but like a kshetra, or like a piece of territory that in and of itself is sacred, and what that means, and how you respect that, I think that's kind of been lost. Because now I think it's kind of like, oh, well, you know, like we'll go to like Kashi and it'll be like a holiday, or we'll go like kind of like for like a honeymoon or things like that. And there's nothing wrong with going on a honeymoon or like having like a fun holiday. But the idea is like when you go to these places, there's a sense of sanctity, or a sense of like you're saying, like reverence. And I think we've kind of lost that, or like what it means to go on like a Tirthyatra. So like, for example, it was said, you know, we've always had this notion, and Diana Eck has a great book on this, but like this, you know, sacred geography of Bharat, you know, so the idea that long before the state of India was formed, we had this sense of nationhood just based on sacred geography. And so if you were in Rameshwaram, if you're in the south, then your idea of going through the Tirthyatra was to go north, because there's the idea of this penance and the sacrifice, and you undertake like a vrata or like some abstinence in that process, and that's kind of like what purifies you. And so when you go, like having darshan isn't just like having a physical process, but it's actually like this whole process that starts well before you embark on the journey. And so how you respect those places, how do you think about development in those places? Like, should you have all these like boutique heritage hotels on the ghats of the Ganga and Kashi? Should you have like riverboat cruises, you know, someone's serving alcohol and stuff like that, like on the Ganga? Like, is that a proper understanding of sacred geography? And so I think it's this understanding the significance of a place and respecting that, but a lot of that does come back on us. It's not just about them versus us. It's about, well, we've been given custodianship of so many sacred sites. Like, what are we doing to protect that or to maintain that?
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot for us to learn there.
Learn about ourselves again.
Yes.
So I'm going to ask you something that this is a comment I often receive, not often, but I do receive on occasion, and you may as well, which is, it's none of your business. You're not from India.
Oh, yeah.
So what business do you have living in your, everyone assumes we all live in McMansions. I don't, you know, in your $3 million mansion, you know, in America, what business do you have inserting your opinion about India? How would you respond to that?
Yeah. So, you know, in the beginning when we were talking and I was saying like, in the future, we're not going to have connections to India. I think it's like in a sense, because I think every Hindu, whether you're ethnically or racially Indian or of Indian heritage or not, has a connection to like what I'll call Bharat, because that's like the Hindu homeland. And it always will be as such. Like that's where devas and rishis were and things like that. And so I think as soon as you have that, there is a sense of duty or an investment or something that comes with that. And so when I speak about these things, I'm not talking as like an Indian, because like, yeah, I don't have that, but as a Hindu, I have a vested interest on what happens to like a Jyotirlinga and things like that. And I think this, so I think that notion itself is kind of like premised wrongly, because again, it makes it this is like an Indian thing, which of course it is. It's in India. But then there is also a Hindu connection which transcends India. Because like on January 22nd, I think you saw a celebration like worldwide. And it was like a momentous occasion for like all Hindus, and that should be like celebrated. And I think comments or feedback or perspective should be welcomed. Just as like I honestly I feel like, you know, Indians comment on American politics all the time, and you know, there are interesting insights there. So like I think you should always welcome all perspectives. Because you could get something interesting out of it. But I think every Hindu has a stake in our sacred sites and therefore has a right to voice concerns or observations.
Well, and as you're talking, I can imagine people who have sort of a vested interest in proving this, saying, oh, well, that's what she's saying is just Hindutva or Hindu nationalist sort of polemics or rhetoric. But what's evident to me as a listener, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on it, is that you're talking about something that goes, it's not about nation. You're talking about ancestry and divinity and, you know, the womb of Hinduism, which is different than nation.
Yes. And I would just say, as for example, like someone who's like, Krishna's my Ishtadevata, right? So that means like my chosen form of the divine. I can't go to Mathura because I've been there once and it was so painful for me. Like I can't go to like the birthplace of like my most beloved God, because when I go there, I just feel this pain. And like, I see that violence. And I see that like desecration and like insult and like affront. And that pain that I feel like as a Hindu, that's not about like nationalism. That's like you said, that transcends it. And I think that's the part that gets, you know, misunderstood a lot, or this kind of translated as this majoritarianism, minority rights kind of thing. And you know, in all this discussion, so I think that notion, like I said, of sacred geography gets lost. And then I think the West is so used to religious disputes kind of being Catholic versus Protestant, like what happened in Western Europe, that every time they see a dispute, they just put it into those terms. And that's really not what's happening here at all. Like, no one seriously says that Muslims don't have right of access to religious sites for worship. There may be this particular site that we say should come back and be reclaimed as a temple, but that doesn't mean like the Muslims of Ayodhya or the Muslims of Kashi don't have other mosques to go to. And so it's not a deprivation of minority rights. And I think there's a difference between nation and state. So I think the state has a fundamental duty to provide for the rights and interests of everyone, including like minorities and all of that. And that has to be safeguarded. But what's happening here isn't really a deprivation of rights, but it's an assertion of a Hindu nation. And I think the assumption is that you can't have a Hindu nation without disenfranchising basically Muslims and Christians. You know, I think Jains and Buddhists and most Sikhs are fine with it. And that's a wrong notion because, you know, like France has a very specific culture and this idea of like French nationhood. The U.S. has that. England has it. And they've all had the privilege of developing this for themselves, you know, like uninterrupted for like, you know, hundreds of years. But now that India or Bharat, after getting statehood, is exploring its identity, its national identity, is creating all of this kind of like anxiety. And so I think that's what we're seeing is kind of like, you can have a Hindu nation, but still have like a state that protects the interests and rights of everyone. I think there's also a discomfort in seeing Prime Minister Narendra Modi so like involved in like the rites and the ceremonies and things like that. And even I kind of like shared that for like a moment. I think it's probably like my like Western upbringing, because it's kind of like, oh, secularism, like maybe that shouldn't happen. But if it hadn't happened and it was just like Purohitas and Panditas and he wasn't there, like from a Hindu perspective, that would not have been appropriate, because like the ruler of a land, or like the, you know, like the king or what, you know, whatever, was always involved because it was his duty, or if it was a queen, her duty to like kind of protect the rite of worship for people, right? So when Sri Rama was a young boy, he went with Vishwamitra to protect the rishis and the brahmanas so they could perform their yajnas and things like that. That's the duty of governance. And so again, in the kind of like an Indian sense, like it's natural and should be that, you know, that the prime minister, that the ruler is involved in some sense, because that's our idea of the interaction between like government and religion and society. It's very different from the Western one. And again, every time there's a deviation from the Western model, it's kind of like, oh, like this is going to lead to like all these terrible consequences. But we don't know that. We're not even given the chance to like demonstrate that. And I think for so many thousands of years of history, we've seen that it has worked on the whole, like, you know, very well. And again, it shouldn't be about looking backward. And I think sometimes there's a sense of if you have like Hindu nationalism, it's about like going back to the past. But I actually think it's like forward looking. Like, I don't think no one's going to forget the West. Like, you could be in India, but like everyone's been impacted by the West. And there are good things we'll take from that. But like looking forward, there may be like a very different idea, like nationhood, that still can promote things that have been of concern in the West, but in a very different way. And we very much deserve the chance to try that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think all of your points are really, really well taken. So we're going to shift gears a little bit, although you've kind of touched upon this. As a lawyer practicing in the US, have you encountered situations where your Hindu background influenced how you approached the work you were doing?
Yeah, I feel like all the time and like in different ways. I think one of it is just finding like perspective. So I'll give you an example. So I'm very like conflict adverse, which isn't like a great trait for a lawyer. But anytime I have to do like a negotiation, I hate it, because I hate the idea of having to like fight or negotiate against someone. And so that was something that was, it always made me very like nervous, and I hated it, and I would avoid it. And that would not have been good for my career in the long term. But one thing that I learned from like a Hindu perspective is like my Guruji had shared with me like a story like in his life where he was kind of like in this potential conflict with someone. And he made kind of like a sankalpa, like when he was doing his sadhana, he was doing his puja, that, you know, like let my interests be protected, but let their interests also be protected. So I let this happen to like the benefit of the whole. And I was like, oh, like that's interesting. And so like that's kind of become like my approach, like for like negotiation. Maybe start with like the other person's like interest. And then also think of like my company's interest or my department, whoever's interest, and try to find like the right answer for like everyone. And like that kind of like that took out for me like this kind of competitive or like win lose or something like that. And that's made it much easier for me also to like advocate, because it's really difficult. And I think especially for women, it's really difficult to negotiate if you're negotiating for yourself. But when you feel like it has also been shown, like if women are like negotiating for their team, then they actually outperform men. And so it's like when you're negotiating from a position of like principle that this is the right answer for like everyone, it gives you like more strength also, and it makes you a better advocate. So that's just like a small example where I feel like that Hindu perspective or the Dharmic perspective has actually directly impacted what I do. The other thing, which I didn't understand for a long time, is the idea of like work as sadhana. And sometimes we think of that as like a very karma yoga, like you volunteer or things like that. But a lot of things I've learned from like human nature, or like the world, or like it just comes from work. Some of like the greatest mentors I've had have been in the workplace. And so this idea of like doing your best at work and learning from that has been very helpful, because I haven't felt like, oh, like, that's something I have to do. Like, I feel like very grateful to have the opportunity to do it. And this kind of sense of like duty, or like my dharma during these like 10 hours is to do the best I can. And it's something actually, I think Hillary Clinton said, is to bloom where you're planted. And that again, that's like a very Hindu idea that like whatever you're doing, just do the best at it. It doesn't matter what it is. So that's been really helpful. I also think like it's been a help in other ways. Like I wear my bindi, like I wear it every day to like the workplace. And my people say like, well, don't you feel like that would like hold you back? People think differently, but it's actually open conversations. And I think it shows people that like you're willing to be yourself and you're willing to be like authentic to yourself. And so I actually think that's been like a good thing. And the other thing I would share is like once, you know, like a few times we've gone on kind of networking trips to like Sonoma, like wine country, and like I don't drink. And I think a lot of times Hindus feel like this pressure to like conform or like, oh, we have to like do this. But I just told people like I'm very happy to go and I feel like that's in a driver and I'll sit and I'll things like that. I'm just not gonna drink. And then you know, there are like other people who like shared with me that like for whatever reason they're not, you know, they're not drinking or they went to peers when they're not drinking. And it again became a way of like bonding. But I think if I'd gone the other way around and just to conform, like I pretended I was drinking and actually drank, like you're never gonna get anywhere if you don't stand out, right? You're just always gonna be one of everyone. So the only way you get ahead is like if you stand out or there's something unique about you. And when you start with that from like a Hindu perspective, we're already gonna be like unique. And I think if you just stay true to that, then it gets respected. And so those are some things, but it's actually been a great benefit to my career.
I really appreciate how you kind of flip that script on being different rather than it being othering. It's actually makes you interesting.
Yes.
It makes you unique. The first point you raised, though, I thought dovetailed nicely with what you were describing about the possibility of. So you were describing how a dharmic or Hindu perspective on a legal matter would take into consideration the other side and what's best for everyone. And I think that's very much the way in which what happened in Ayodhya was mediated. What's best for everyone. And so if that's just a small example of what it means to be a Hindu nation, it actually could be incredibly powerful and beautiful to be a Hindu nation, because being a Hindu nation is not about, it doesn't mean that everybody is Hindu, but that it's a Hindu approach.
Right.
To governance, to thinking about what a nation is. And your example, I think, was a beautiful and powerful example of how that can play out in ways that are actually the most inclusive and have the highest degree of integrity.
Yeah. And I really believe that because,
yeah,
like we're seeing right now, like the largest mosque in the, you know, in the world, yeah, in India with like the largest Quran in the world coming up, like in Ayodhya itself. So, I don't think that would happen under like other other frameworks.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So how do you see your work, whether it's, you know, conversations like this and the writing that you do contributing to the broader Hindu community or Hindu American community? What would you love to see happen from it?
Yeah, this is like a really hard question for me because I feel like, especially with like social media, and I remember this, like, you know, when my book came out, it's like first time, like first you hear like your book's going to be published, it's like, wow, like this is amazing. And then like that wears off in like a day or two. And like the book comes out and like, oh, that's like amazing. And then that, you know, evaporates in a day or two. And then it's like, oh, like how many copies did I sell? And like, oh, like here's another similar book. And how many copies does that sell? And in social media, I feel like you're just like surrounded by that. Like, people write similar posts, like how many likes did you get? How many shares did you get? And things like that. And it becomes very like results obsessed. And I think for a while I was kind of thinking in those terms. I was like, oh, well, what do I do to like maximize my output and things like that? And some of that you have to do because some of that is just like practical and like you have to be intentional and conscious of things and things like that. But for me, it's becoming less about that and more about I'm trying to think, but like there's this story I love from Buddhism, and it's really become an inspiration for me, which is like there was this Zen master who was supposed to give a Dharma talk, and he went to this like remote mountainous areas and no one showed up. But he still gave his talk. And at the end of that, like the rocks bowed down to him in gratitude for it. And I love that because it's just this idea that it doesn't matter. And my husband had gotten for me this like small Ganesha, and this Ganesha is sitting like on a rocking chair and he's holding like a book. And so I look at that every time I write because I'm like, oh, it's like at least Ganesha is going to read it. And for me, it's just like, it just takes out so much stress and anxiety. If I just think like, whatever I'm doing, if I'm doing it with like the sincerity and intent, like whatever result is meant to come will come. That doesn't mean like I'm not human. I don't think about all those other things. But for me, I kind of think about like, what is it with my time that I can do and that kind of comes naturally, and then like trying to do like my best at it, and then kind of trusting that Krishna will put in front of me what I'm supposed to do at that moment, and then it'll kind of like work out. And I'm trying to go more into that framework versus trying to be like more like planned, or you know, kind of like very planned and organized in that way.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a very dharmic perspective, right? To just be an instrument and offer and surrender it. And then whatever happens, happens.
And it's really hard. And I would say, I think part of that also that requires like honesty. So like something like, you know, my guru and I talk about, I'm like, well, when I write, like part of me just, I just really want to be a best-selling author. Like that's just like, I just have that vasana in me, or I have that ambition in me. And I don't want to be dishonest about that. I don't want to just say I'm just doing it to be an insult, because like that would be like an ahankar of like a different kind. But I think it's recognizing that yeah, I'd love to do that, but I'm also going to try to do these other things, and then just like accept that. And like, there's nothing wrong with wanting to be a best author, or wanting like fame or recognition, and like being honest about it. And like a part of what's motivating me is this. Mm-hmm. And giving space for that, while also trying to balance with that and like moving more towards like this other direction. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's kind of the space where I'm in.
Well, I will say that it's impossible to be a best-selling author in 2024 without being very active on social media. So we will continue to support you in those efforts. But
I actually want to bring that up because you were super helpful to me, because and this is actually an example of how both of these things come together, because you reached out to me and said, you have to be like on Instagram. Like I have like no idea how to do it. And you took the time to like teach me how to do it. And after that happened, I was telling my husband this. I'm like, this is such a sign of serendipity to me, because first of all, it was kind of you to do that. And that meant a lot to me. But then I'm also like, oh, this is like a sign from Ishvara that I have to like be like more active. And I have to do these things. But then also see how kind Ishvara is, because he knows I'm totally like ignorant and incompetent at this. So he sent me like the teacher who would like show me how to do this. And like to me, like that was kind of like a lesson in like sadhana as well, as like, okay, I have to go and do these very practical things. So I appreciate that.
Thank you. I was thrilled that you were receptive to it, because I kind of inserted myself into that situation. So let's play for a moment. And you know, I know I'm just kind of throwing this question at you. Imagine a few generations from now, the future. So beyond kind of our scope of understanding of what society might even look like, right? Because with technology and everything shifting so rapidly, we don't really know what things are going to look like. What can you imagine are some expressions or signs of Hindu Americanism? Here.
That's a great question. I would love to see it in like the arts and like literature, where it's not just featuring like a Hindu person, but like literally like written from like a Hindu perspective. So like, you know, like we have so many like fantasy or epic fantasies that are based on basically it's just like Middle Age Europe, and just like kind of dressed up in different ways. But I'd love to see that kind of thing like based like a dharmic world. So you ever see that in some like Chinese dramas where it takes place in a very like Confucian or Buddhist worldview and like the heavens and things like that. But I'd love to see that happen, because I think there's so much scope for there. For Hindus, I'd like to see, I would love to see Hindus feel free to like take Shivratri as like a holiday at work and like, you know, feel free to like celebrate it and like take the day off at work and like kind of have that nishta in our festivals and holidays. I was so happy. Like the other day I went to like the BAPS, like Robbinsville temple. And what I loved is there's so many like young people. Cause sometimes I go to the temples. And I'm like, you know, like it's just an aging population. Like who's going to, we have these beautiful buildings, but who's actually going to be there in the next year? But like, I loved going there and seeing all these young people. Cause I feel like we have like a space, but I would love to see those kind of like spaces for us. And I think temples will be different. I think they'll be like abodes for the devas, but I think they'll also be like hopefully gathering spaces for us. Yeah, I'd love to see kind of like space for practices and sadhana and like just like being able to talk about sadhana and that just become like a normal everyday thing. I would say more representation of like Hindus and like in government and things like that. But yeah, I think there's so much. It's hard to like imagine, but
I think those are some really beautiful examples that are great callbacks to our conversation that we've had today. All right, so what is some advice you'd give to?
There is one more thing.
Sure, go for it.
I would love to see Hindus like keep names that are hard to pronounce.
Yes.
And I would, you know, this actually happened when my husband came here. So his first name is Vishwajit. And at first, every time I would like mention it, they'd be like, oh, I can't remember that. So then at first I was like, oh, it's okay. You can just call him like B or like Jeet or whatever. And then like I introduced him to some people. And I guess like he didn't like it. And I didn't like it either. He's like, you know, it's not that hard. You can spend like 30 seconds, like learn how to pronounce it. Like it's not that hard. But we have a hard time like asking people to take like 30 seconds, just remind like, and Beatrice is a very beautiful, meaningful name. Like all of our names are so beautiful and meaningful. And I think we have this tendency to either so try to make it easy to pronounce. Like for me, I was actually in this program at work. I was in a DI program. Like we had to kind of make like a resolution at the beginning of it. And I was like, you know, when I introduce myself, I usually introduce myself as like a DT, because that's like the name that people can pronounce. But you know, there's no reason I could just say Aditi and then people can pronounce it the best way they can. But at least I'm pronouncing my name correctly. And that was like hard for me. And this is like a year ago. But it's like small things like that, I think, of just like keeping authenticity without being off-putting, right? Like I'm not going to be like offended if someone can't pronounce my name, but I think like that those kinds of things, like being willing to hold on to those things, like very little ways. But I would love to just see more of that.
Yeah. And, you know, I did something similar. Indu is the obvious pronunciation of my name in the West. But I started just using Indu when I was teaching in grad school, and people got it. It was not, there was the only block was my mind. It wasn't actually a block for anybody else. And they were actually quite thrilled that they got to say it in an authentic way.
Yes.
And I actually had a couple of colleagues who had been referring to me as Indu earlier who were quite angry at me. They're like, why didn't you tell me I was saying it the wrong way earlier? I missed out on an opportunity to actually engage with you authentically. Because how we're called, you know, does really, really make a difference. And you like code switch when your name is mispronounced.
Yes.
Right. It has actually a profound impact on how you're engaging in the space. So I really, really appreciate that. I think for me, what comes up, especially as an educator, is when we do that, we're depriving other people of opportunities to engage with worlds that they wouldn't have access to otherwise.
Right. And it's also in a way insulting to them, right? Because you're just assuming that they're not going to take the time or they don't want to learn to say it the right way.
Yeah, absolutely. I just had my 30th high school reunion in the fall, and some of my classmates like proudly came up to me and said that they had never forgotten how to pronounce my last name and they were still pronouncing it perfectly.
Oh, that's great.
Which is fantastic. I think I just dated myself. So what is one or two pieces of advice you were a child of immigrants that you would give to immigrant Hindu parents here in the US?
I think one would be not to ghettoize ourselves. And I think it's really easy to do that now because there's so many, especially like a place like New Jersey, there's so many like Indians all around. Like you can just hang out with Indians all day. You can move to like a neighborhood where it's all Indian. It's everywhere. And I see this like a lot. And I think it's a real missed opportunity, right? Because we have to build bridges to like other communities. We have to understand the country that we're living in. I think nowadays there's a real lack of understanding because I think people just rely on like social media or like, you know, like their blogs or like other things like that. And they don't really have like an on the ground understanding of like what's happening here. So I think one is like just interacting with like different, all kinds of different communities here and really becoming part of that community here. And when you do that, then you're able to like make an impact. But if you're always, we're just hanging out with ourselves, we're not going to impact anyone. We're not going to make our mark in any way. And it makes it hard for like, you know, for like kids too. So that would be one thing. And the other would be to find, you know, like I said, like that authenticity. So like, you know, like how can you celebrate your, you know, like your vratas or like our practices and things like that. And kind of being an ambassador, an advocate for that. So, you know, whether it's like going to like a school and like doing an educational thing, like what is Diwali and things like that. And part of this also means like learning ourselves because we don't always know. But really taking that seriously, because being an immigrant parent is, it's like you're setting the tone for like generations. So this is this great responsibility. And it's a very hard balance. And I kind of like marvel at like what, you know, my parents and like their generation did, because it's like so tough to like come to like a new country with nothing and like build it from scratch. Like it's really amazing.
And there was no, I mean, my parents immigrated in the mid-60s. There was no WhatsApp. There was no internet back then either. Yeah.
And there's so much sacrifice that goes into that. And I think like, I think like immigrant parents as a whole always sacrifice so much for their kids to have the opportunity. And I think a lot of times it's focused on like financial or security, which makes a lot of sense. But just to balance that with the idea that like you're coming with all this heritage gifts, and don't deprive your children of that. And just sharing that with them and like kind of fiercely protecting that, because just as more precious than like the financial wealth or like the education that you invest in is that civilizational, spiritual and metaphysical like wealth. And to kind of fiercely guard that and share that pass that on.
So there's this beautiful balance you've described, right? Don't ghettoize, but also continue to be stewards of the civilizational wealth, both at the same time, and finding that balance. It's not easy, but you know, I completely resonate with what you're saying. It's a part of being here and being Hindu at the same time.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
And then, the next obvious question is, what is some advice you would give to young Hindu Americans?
I think it's almost like very similar to that. I think it's like it's you know, not being afraid to be different. So it's like one thing. Like I remember years ago, you know, when it comes to like birthday cakes and blowing out a candle, like to me, it was just like habit. So I was like, of course you do it. And then like, you know, so I was like, you shouldn't really blow out candles because like that's it's like very inauspicious. When I first heard it, like it was kind of like abstract to me and it was kind of like intellect. And I was like, oh, okay. But then now it's something like I can't imagine like blowing out like a candle. Like to me, that'd just be like, so like, that'd be like a terrible thing to like to do. And I think it's like things that we take for kind of like granted all around us when you like think about it or look at it from a new perspective. Because that's, like I said, like what makes you different is what's going to make you stand out. And that's how you kind of like contribute to things. And I think that's what's great about America is like this kind of focus on being original. Like I remember when I was in law school and I was writing papers, it really frustrated me because you couldn't just write a paper saying here, these are like 12 different scholars said about a topic, because the professor was like, what's your original contribution? Like, what's your original thought? And that was like really difficult for me. I'm like, I don't have one. And there's this kind of focus on this, which now I've come to appreciate, because then that makes you think about things in different perspectives. And like, we are uniquely situated coming from, like, Hinduism is so different from like the Western kind of Judeo-Christian framework. And so we're going to have these original thoughts to contribute. And America like welcomes that and celebrates that. And so it's kind of like our duty to do that. And the more we kind of feel this insecurity or this inferiority complex, and we just want to conform, you know, like we're deprived, like we've been discussing, we're trying not just ourselves, but others of like what we can contribute. And so I think there are a lot of things like that where we will have a very different perspective. In India, I think because of colonialism, we've been hamstrung for so long. I think the hangover of that is going to last much longer in India than it has to here. Mm. And so I think that gives us an opportunity to be kind of at like the forefront of a lot of these things that will then like travel back to like our Hindu brothers and sisters in India. But we have this opportunity to contribute that. And I think we really should. So it's even in like very small things, but it's even like in like bigger things, like Hindu positions on different policies and thinking about those things. And like I said, it's unfortunate because Hinduism becomes so limited to just like Indian politics, but there are just like so many things on like, you know, all these issues around gender and sexuality and all these issues that we're confronting today. We have like a very unique perspective. And so I think it's delving into like really understanding Hinduism from a first principles basis, and then applying that to all these new things like AI, you know, like just things like that. Is AI, can AI develop consciousness?
Yeah.
Like it's kind of like a Zen koan, like does a dog have Buddha nature? But these are things that there aren't like easy answers for, and we can be a part of that. And I think that's a great opportunity, and it's also like our duty to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, wonderful. Well, you've talked about your book. Are there any other upcoming projects that you would like our listeners to know about?
So I have like three other books that I'm kind of like working on. I keep like shuffling between them. So one I'm actually working on is like, it would be like a contemporary like novel about kind of like a Hindu American like woman and this experience that she goes through, where she's like working as a lawyer, and she's been asked to defend this this museum that has like a stolen murti from India.
Wow.
And it's kind of like this case that she's working on, and then that makes her like confront all these things from her past. So that's been kind of interesting, because it's like, you know, I've been talking sometimes we have to be like forward looking, but like when I think about Hindus, I kind of go back to like the Mahabharata. So like my first books were all about like the Hindu Puranas and stuff like that. And that's kind of like comfortable. But then like taking like, well, I want to write something very Hindu, but like very like contemporary. It's like really hard, but it's also like, I want it, like it's been exciting. So I'm going to try that.
Well, you got to write that one, because I already want to read it. So you need to write that one. And you said two other books also?
Yeah, so there's another one I want to write about Mirabai, but not so much as like a historical fiction, but more as kind of like a speculative fiction, kind of like a fantasy setting almost. But like, I'm still working that out. Yeah.
Wonderful. And the third book?
The third book is, it's about like Indra, but it would be like, so Indra, like the Deva, but it would kind of be something like the trials of Indra, where he's been sent to like Earth to kind of like undergo like a mortal birth. Mm-hmm. But this is like an Earth kind of like set in like a different time where like British colonialism never ended. Mm-hmm. And he's kind of born into like an India under like British colonialism still.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's really interesting. I can see that almost being like a TV show, like a screenplay.
Yeah,
right. Wonderful. Well, look forward to reading all of those. My last question is, where can people find your work and stay connected with you?
So I'm most active on Facebook, but because of you, I'm also going to be active on Instagram and Twitter, or X.
Right. And so what are your handles there?
So it's abanner01. So ABANER01.
And that's for both X and for Instagram.
Yes.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. This has been such a delight to speak with you. I feel like we could talk for hours longer. thank you so much for your time and your insights. You are such a treasure, and I really, really appreciate, and I'm so grateful to know you.
Thank you so much for like inviting me, and for this has just been great. And you're such an inspiration to me. So I really appreciate it.
I'm humbled. Thank you so much.
Well, that's it for this episode of That's So Hindu. If you enjoyed it, please take a minute and leave us a nice 5-star review. It's how you can help the show get discovered by more listeners. You can help ensure that more of these get made by making a donation to HAF at hinduamerican.org/donate. Thanks again for listening.